If you can tell us a bit of Gonsi.
Would you introduce us?
Sure. My name's Dr. Tom Pierre Shonek. I'm a member of MedACT, member of the Tyneside branch of MedACT as well as a board member of a MedACT committee. I've been involved in leading a group that's writing a report about the health effects of armed drones. We're hoping to launch the report the first week of October to coincide with the Drones Campaign Week. 2 weeks after that, we're hoping to launch it again at the House of Commons. I'm waiting on a confirmatory date from John McDonnell, but we think it's going to be most likely 23rd of October. John's just going to get back to me with the dates and times. So if anyone's in London...
Good.
I've prepared a short talk here, just giving instruction on the use of drones, which are becoming an increasingly stable part of the weaponry of numerous governments. So I'll start by giving a bit of instruction about the history of aerial warfare. And the first recorded instance of aerial bombing was back in 1911. Ironically, Libya was being bombed in those days as well. On that occasion, the Italians were at war with the Ottoman Empire. They were trying to take advantage of the declining Ottoman Empire. As part of that battle, the Italian pilot flew a plane and dropped 4 bombs over the side of the aeroplane, dropped them over by hand. It didn't hit anything, but it was the first recorded instance of a bomb being dropped from a plane. The year before, the American Air Force had experimented by dropping sandbags at planes at targets below in the Nevada desert. Fast forwarding about two decades, the first recorded instance of an aerial bombardment being used against civilians was during the Spanish Civil War. I've mentioned Guernica in the presentation, because that's what everyone knows about. The actual first occasion was the year before. Madrid had been bombed in 1935 by the Condor Legion, which was a group of Luftwaffe volunteers fighting on the side of Franco. Fast forwarding again about 7-8 years. Middle to end of 1944, we begin to see V1 rockets being used. The V1 rocket's basically the first unmanned aerial vehicle, so to speak, because it could be propelled, you fired it, it would go in one direction, it would run out of fuel and then crash on the target below. But it was kind of the first instance that we saw unmanned aerial robotics come into play. A lot of that technology was later on seized by the USSR and the Americans after the war. And the Americans then developed their cruise missiles in the subsequent decades, but a lot of that technology they used was seized from the Germans after the war. The Americans began to deploy cruise missiles around the bases in Western Europe in the mid-50s. They then began to experiment with RPVs, which they termed remotely piloted vehicles. Following the bad experience they had in the Korean War, they realised that actually it's not good to lose your own pilots in a battle. So instead of sending your own pilots in, we'll send in remotely piloted vehicles to basically spy on the enemy below. We'll send them on risky surveillance missions rather than risking lives for our own pilots. They continued this during Vietnam. They realised, well, it's better to send in, for example, the aerial reconnaissance missions where you've got to send in a plane that's going to go quite low to take photographs. It's better to send in a drone rather than a manned plane. The Israelis did the same thing in 1973. They were losing a lot of their F-16s to Syrian artillery batteries, so they used drones as decoys. They'd send them over Syrian airspace. The Syrians would shoot down the drones and use up all their ammunition shooting down the drones, and then the Israeli Air Force would come in and bomb later. That was Yom Kippur War. Fast forwarding again, a couple of decades, we saw Gulf War I, Kosovo. Drones were further developed for surveillance purposes, as well as gathering intelligence. It's just a picture of the first plane from which a bomb was dropped in 1911. Pretty flimsy in those days. Unfortunately, advanced quite a lot since then. That's Guernica. Looking towards modern times, the Americans were sort of inspired by the experience of the Kosovo War, and they thought, well, okay, we can use drones for mapping and surveillance of enemy territory. Let's see what happens if we actually put a bomb on the end of one, or a missile. Can we actually take out a target from using a drone. So they did a test. In February 2001, they fired a missile at an unmanned target in the Nevada desert. Later on, it was actually in November that year, they first used a Predator drone to assassinate an alleged Al-Qaeda leader in Afghanistan, Mohammad Atef, and seven other people were killed, and seven others weren't considered. They were considered collateral damage. But so that was in November 2001. A Reaper drone was used, Predator drone was used to target, to take out a live target. I mean, since then, drone production has increased exponentially. At the moment, we have drone operators sitting 7,000 miles away in Creech Air Force Base in Nevada. A lot of the drones that are operated over Afghanistan and Iraq are actually, they're launched from Iraq, from a forward operating base in Iraq and Afghanistan, but mid-flight, a crew will take over in America, say, often from Creech. So the operators are flying a drone from 7,000 miles away, essentially operating it as if it were on a, as if it were part of a video game. This I'll come on more to this issue later, but as you can probably see, this leads to an asymmetrical warfare gap. Basically, this haves and have-nots. But one side possessing immense warfare, which they have immense sort of aerial power, which they're able to launch at the risk of themselves, versus another side that can do nothing. It brings up issues about whether does this lower threshold to warfare. If one side can now literally launch a war with little risk to themselves, does that make warfare more likely? Because traditionally in the past, one thing that would hold you back from launching a war would be the fact that you'd see body bags coming home. I mean, public opinion would obviously count against you, as we saw happening in the Iraq and Afghan wars. Public opinion in the US, Britain, Australia, other NATO countries turned against the leaders because they are dead and wounded, they're still coming home. But if you can now have a war without any of your, a clean war, or at least clean from your perspective, without seeing any of your people coming home, then it's going to mean two things. Politicians will be, leaders will be more likely to launch a war, and they won't have to worry about the after effects of our public opinion. At the moment, last year, armed drones were used in six countries: Afghanistan, Pakistan, Yemen, Somalia, Libya, and Gaza. One of these drones, RQ Sentinel, which is a prototype US drone, crashed in Iran at the back end of 2011. And the Iranians have been since trying to reverse engineer it. I don't know if the Iranians have the technology, but the Chinese and the Russians certainly have the technology to reverse engineer those drones. So who knows, maybe the Iranians have or might sell the drone to the Russians or the Chinese. At the moment, the US has the largest drone fleet. It's got 7,500 drones. They're not all armed, mind. Some are very small, weighing 20 kilos, that you actually launch. You can basically launch by hand. They vary from those tiny ones all the way to Predator B, the Predator B drone, or the Reaper drone, which weighs a couple of tons and is basically armed with Hellfire missiles. They've also got large Global Hawk drones, which are used for spying. I mean, Israel's cashed in on the drone market. It's the biggest seller of drones. With companies like Elbit Systems, which have been involved in selling the renting out the Hermes 450 drone to the British Army. And they've also been involved with Thales UK, in joint venture to produce the Watchkeeper drone for Afghanistan. And at the moment, we've got 50 countries who are seeking to acquire drone technology. So you can see from 10 years ago, the Americans had basically first fired a drone missile. Between then and now, you've got 50 countries now that either have or are seeking to acquire technology. So you're talking about new arms races coming up. I mean, the UK currently has 5 Reaper drones they bought from General Atomics in the US. Cameron wants to double that by 2013. He wants to double our Reaper drone fleet to 10 drones. That would mean it will be able to fly 3 drones 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. If we have 10, we'll be able to fly at least 3 over Afghanistan. I mean, the British have only used drones over Afghanistan, whereas the Americans have used them in Somalia, Pakistan, Yemen. Israel predominantly uses them in Gaza.
Do the British fly their own drones, or do the Americans?
We operate our own drones. Mm. They're not, when I say our own drones, they're drones we bought from America. Mm. Where Britain's actually seeking to develop its own drone. Back in 2011, it launched a prototype called the Taranis. That was actually a picture I had on the front slide. And that was meant to be sort of looking forward towards developing, a semi-autonomous drone in the future. And they've since developed the Mantis. And basically the move is to, by 2020, have, rather than having a human in the loop, have the human on the loop. In other words, having drones being able to be almost semi-autonomous. I mean, in the future, the drone manufacturers want to eventually have drones that will be able to select their own targets. We're talking sort of 2 or 3 decades in the future, but the Mantis prototype is a one step towards that. Also, in view of the economic crisis, Britain and France have decided to link up and pool their resources to create a joint drone called Telemos, which they're hoping to have in operation by 2018. And mine's just been put back now because due to budget cuts. And Sarkozy's no longer leader, because he originally signed that with the agreement with Cameron. I mean, a lot of people have expressed concerns about drones, not least Christoph Haines, who's the UN, or who was rather, the UN Special Rapporteur on extrajudicial killings. He said that international standards provide adequate room for states to pursue their legitimate security interests, both at home and abroad. Abusing them to meet short-term needs, especially in counter-terrorism operations, could do long-term damage to the protection of human rights. I mean, you can see why, from the point of view of NATO, America, drones are quite clean, because you're not putting your own soldiers' lives at risk. You can hover over a target for basically days at a time. So they use the term, I mean, NATO have been using the term dull, dangerous, and dirty. I think drones eliminate tasks that are dull. They can hover for long periods of time. A human pilot would get tired after have to come down after 8 hours. They can fly over areas that would be deemed dangerous. And they can target them to basically dirty missions. Say, they can fly over and take out a target in a remote location, which might be both risky and difficult to do if you had a manned aircraft. I mean, there have been a lot of reports of civilian casualties associated with the use of drones. The problem is, though, we've got no accurate readings, often because the casualties occur in remote places like Somalia, Waziristan, Yemen. The sites of drone attacks are often very hard to reach, and often there have been reports of rescuers being targeted by a second drone. And the US have a system called Double Tap, where they launch a missile, and then a little while later they launch a second missile, the Double Tap. And often the second missile targets families, rescue workers that come in to help remove the bodies of those injured and killed by the first drone. I mean, the UN have actually raised concerns about this and said that if this doesn't stop, they're going to do something about it, which is something I often say. The Americans obviously say, well, you know, we're not targeting ambulances, we're not targeting civilians. I mean, I'll talk a little bit later about how they choose their targets, because at the moment, certainly in Pakistan, I can't speak for other countries, but in Pakistan, any sort of military-aged male is considered a legitimate target unless proven otherwise. That's why the Americans, and even the RAF, last year the RAF said there'd only been 4 civilian deaths from drones. And the US have claimed, I mean, Paul, I think it was, I can't remember his name, it was one of the previous... it was one of the previous legal advisors to Obama. Not Bremer, some... anyway, he claimed that there were no civilian casualties in 1 year. I mean, actually, even the New York Times laughed at him in an editorial over this. But their rationale is, well, if they're a military-age male, i.e. anyone 40 and upwards, then they're a terrorist unless proven otherwise. And it's very difficult to prove otherwise when there's body bits on the ground. I mean, drones have... I mean, if you want figures for civilian casualties, the best place to look is the New America Foundation or the Bureau for Investigative Journalism. But again, it's difficult to actually get an accurate picture because very few people actually go to sites from drone attacks. They create a climate of fear. In Gaza, for example, there have been reports of civilians suffering PTSD because they know the Israeli drones are hovering ahead. They can't hear them or see them. The modern drones they can't hear or see. They know they're there, and they know that they could be killed at any time. But there's nothing you can do about it. It's basically fish in a barrel. You're in an open prison. You could be shot at. You could be... have a hellfire missile blown up your house at any moment, and there's nothing you can do. So that creates some extreme amounts of stress and PTSD. There's also been one report released by Pax Christi last year, which talked about PlayStation mentality. Because if you have these operators that are a lot of them actually, originally the drone operators were ex-pilots, and they'd led solo missions before, but nowadays they're recruiting people who've actually never been in an aeroplane. So you're getting people 18, 19, 20 who've never been in a combat zone operating these drones on a screen. In fact, the drone controller they use is actually adjusted to model the PlayStation controller. The idea being that if they spend so many years playing PlayStation, it'll be easy to adapt. So if you're killing people from 7,000 miles away, you're not in a battlefield, it's quite logical that you'll begin to think of things as a game. You'll see people being killed on a screen, but like a computer game, you'll never be there. You'll be sitting in a chair, you'll be at no risk. There'll be no risk to yourself. There have been reports of the drone personnel having mental health issues, and the jury's still out on this. Because some reports say that the drone operators do show higher signs of stress than other personnel in the US Air Force. But a lot of this was deemed to be down to the shift patterns they were doing, because they were doing funny shifts. So whether it's down to what they're doing or down to the shift patterns remains to be seen. This is just an image picture of what a drone of a target would look like from a video screen.
What distance is that?
The distance that I'm afraid I have no idea. I don't know how far away that is. But the drones can zoom in, so they could be flying 2 miles above, but appear quite close. Because they were quite good zooms nowadays. That's a Predator drone, which is normally armed with, I think it's a dozen Hellfire missiles or 2 500-pound bombs. As I mentioned earlier, you've got an asymmetrical warfare gap. You've got one side possessing its immense force, being able to launch an attack, literally from the comfort of their own armature. They're able to launch an attack with little risk to themselves. I suppose the only risk is if a suicide bomber came and blew up the drone base in the middle of the Nevada desert. It's quite unlikely, but essentially the risks to themselves are minimal. And when they finish their shift, they'll go home to their families. So they're different to they're in a different boat to soldiers in Afghanistan and Iraq, because at the end of the day, they'd go back home to their own families. There's been a lot of talk of drones being used for extrajudicial killings. Obama did promise change, but we didn't all expect the change to be from torture to killing. Bush would capture people, we had extraordinary rendition, kidnap, Guantanamo Bay torture. Obama doesn't capture people anymore. It's more efficient to kill them instead. Also, dead men tell no tales. So, if you get captured going to Guantanamo Bay, you might one day get out and be released. If you're killed in a drone strike, you'll never speak again. There's recently been, New York Times revealed a few months ago that there's an existence of something called Kill List, where once a month on a Tuesday, Obama meets with several dozen NSA, National Security Agency members, and they will recommend to him who to put on a list. They'll say basically, we think this person's dangerous, we think he's dangerous, we think she's dangerous. There'll be women put on this list as well. And we think they're a threat to the US, and therefore we think they should go on a kill list. And Obama approves the names, or together with his committee, he approves the names. And then from that list, they choose targets for drone strikes. I don't know if you're aware, there's been a recent case, September last year, there's three US citizens killed in a drone attack in Yemen. There's Al Awlaki, his 16-year-old son, who was actually killed in a later drone strike. In the initial drone strike, had Al Awlaki and someone called Samir Khan, who were both US citizens, killed in Yemen. And later on, Al Awlaki's son was killed a month later in a separate drone strike. And up to now, despite numerous Freedom of Information requests, and despite requests from the ACLU, Association for Civil Liberties Unions, and public interest lawyers in the US, the US refuses to release the justification of the drone strike. They refuse to basically release, say, why they killed these US citizens, apart from saying no threat to the US. But you can ask the precedent forming. If the US can kill, if Obama can sanction the murder of his own citizens abroad, without sort of any legal process. I mean, he said it's due process. He said it doesn't have to be legal process as long as it's a due process. I.e., that basically means as long as the decision's been made, it's okay. It doesn't have to be a legally justifiable decision as long as the decision's been made. I.e., as long as my advisors and I get together and decide on who we're going to kill, that's fine. I mean, you can see, obviously, if you put so much power into the hands of one man or a small group of men, basically making the president judge, jury, executioner. It completely overrides the whole US Constitution and sets a very dangerous precedent for what's to come. I mean, the Taliban have actually recent suicide bombings in Pakistan, as well as an attempted suicide bombing in Times Square, which was foiled, have been said to be down. They have been said to be in retaliation to drone strikes. Faisal, who tried to set off a bomb in Times Square last year, said that he was doing so in retaliation for drone strikes. He'd actually been in Pakistan, witnessed one in the aftermath. There was an attack on a US base across the border in Afghanistan, where 7 CIA agents were killed, and that was supposedly meant to be in retaliation for drone strikes as well. So basically, you see this violence breeding more violence. And actually, more recently, one of the Taliban commanders in Waziristan said that so long as Americans keep launching drone strikes here, we're going to stop polio vaccines coming in. So you can see the wider problem, that you've got people who are not involved in the conflict being people who aren't involved in the conflict being a threat. I think Pakistan's only one of three countries that still has polio. So if the Taliban are going to ban polio vaccines in retaliation for the drone strikes as a way of sort of holding the US to ransom, you can see the wider health implications of that. The other problem is accountability. Maybe this is deliberate, but who actually is accountable when things go wrong? Is it the intelligence services? Is it the software designers, the engineers, or is it the drone operators? There have been some reports of, because all the intelligence that the Americans receive in Pakistan are fed to them by the ISI, the Pakistani Intelligence Services, and there have been some reports that of deliberate intelligence being fed. For example, Baitullah Mesud was the leader of the Pakistani Taliban, who was killed a few years ago. He wasn't deemed to be a threat to the US, but Pakistan wanted him out of the way. So they said, so they said to the Americans, well, he's a target, he's a militant. He was subsequently eliminated. So you can sort of see the bias there. If the ISI wants someone eliminated, they can say to America, look, you know, that's a bad guy. He's a threat to you. Go take him out. Coming back home to the UK, an internal MOD briefing stressed the importance of having a communication strategy for drones. And the briefing actually said, the MOD actually acknowledged the public disquiet to do with drones. And they said, well, we've basically just got to sell it to the public. We've got to think of a way of making this more palatable. There's actually a link here in my presentation I can send to anyone afterwards, which actually, this is actually the MOD presentation, slides 20, 21, talk about having a communication strategy and engaging with the public and making drones appear like any other form of warfare, no different to launching a bomb from a normal plane. The MOD is not keen to share information. I think to date there have been, I can't say how many strikes the US has done, because it's deemed to be in the hundreds across the board. But the UK has, until May this year, launched 281 drone strikes in Afghanistan. The problem is, though, we only have information for 40% of them. Information is sort of released in bit by bit. If you read the weekly IRF reports, they occasionally release information saying a drone strike was launched in area X, it hit target Y, it killed X number of militants. Beyond that, and that's only happens occasionally, beyond that, 60% of the drone strikes that the UK launches, we hear nothing about. One of the things that the report I'm writing is calling for is calling for greater transparency. One of our recommendations calls for the British government to basically open up and release more information about how they select targets, who selected, the death toll, how many of them are civilians, who's in charge. Basically release more information to do with the whole process. I mean, the same thing's happening in the US, actually. 26 senators wrote to Obama a few months ago saying they want clarification on signature strikes. The actual way in which drone strikes are happening is changing as well. In the early stages, the Americans launched a drone strike against a specific target. For example, this is a Taliban commander, we will kill him, and launch a target to kill him. Now they've become more specific. Rather than saying, we are launching a drone strike to take out target X, they're saying, we're going to fly around with a drone until we find a target. That's how it's changed. It's gone from we are taking out a specific target to we are looking for signs of suspicious activity. And that's actually what's termed signature strikes. The signature strike is one where the target's undefined. You basically hover, fly a drone around until you find people acting suspiciously. As I mentioned, the MOD's been quite secretive about the use of drones. I mean, a bigger problem is actually the CIA. Because it's actually, in America, there's three separate drone fleets. You've got the US Army Air Force operating one, you've got the CIA operating a second, and you've got JSOC, which stands for Joint Special Operations Command, operating a third. And the most secretive of the lot is actually JSOC. We know next to nothing about them. But what we do, there is some belief that JSOC's actually using contractors from companies like Blackwater to fly the drones, or be involved in the drone flying process. But of the three different groups operating drones in America, the CIA and JSOC are the ones who are least forthcoming. I mean, the CIA deny the whole thing, actually, so they still deny this. They say, you know, we neither confirm or deny this, so everyone knows what's going on, but the CIA still haven't come clean. And the drone market's expanding. It's gone up by about 400% in the last decade. And as I mentioned earlier in the presentation, there's a new arms race. Israel's exporting to numerous countries. Russia's bought drones from Israel. Singapore, India, and China have produced their own drones. Canada most recently wants to launch its own drone for surveillance purposes. And the one thing to point out is there's only three countries so far that have armed drones. They are US, UK, and Israel. Other countries that have drones are only have them for surveillance, for spying purposes. But of course, it's not difficult to put a missile on a drone. Mm. You know, I mean, originally the US was using drones for spying purposes in the Kosovo War. 2-3 years later, they were using armed drones in Afghanistan. Talking about surveillance, you've got a whole other issue coming in here. Police forces in the US want to use drones to spy, to catch criminals and spy on protesters. In fact, by 2015, Obama's ordered the FAA, which is the Federal Aviation Authority, to basically open up civilian airspace to allow drones to fly in the US. In the UK, we're still more strict. The CAA, Civil Aviation Authority, up till now, doesn't allow drones to be flown in civilian airspace unless they're less than 20 kilos and flown within 400 metres of the operator and outside civilian areas. But I mean, what happens in the US often tends to follow what happened here a few years later. So if already in the US you've got Obama opening up restrictions to allow drones to be flown in civilian airspace, you've got police forces wanting to use drones to spy on people, you can kind of see what's going to happen. You can kind of see that could be setting a precedent for the UK 5-10 years down the line. The UK drone fleet is at the moment based and operated from Nevada, but at some point, it was meant to happen in June this year, it's been delayed. The RAF drone pilots based at Nevada are going to come to Lincoln, to Waddington Air Base, and start operating drones from UK soil. They're meant to do so from June 2012, but it's not happened yet. And the RAF aren't giving us a firm date because they know that a whole lot of protesters will converge. And that's what we're trying to do, basically, converge and trespass. But as yet, the RAF pilots haven't been moved to Waddington. I've talked about civilian potential use of... We've still got strict CIA rules, but the Americans haven't got... They've got more lax FAA rules, so what happens there could well follow here. I mean, Obama wants drones to be flown alongside aeroplanes in civilian airspace by 2015. Just a bit about the Drones Campaign Network. MEDACT is a member of the Drones Campaign Network, which is basically a group of individuals and organisations that come together. We've got groups like Drone Wars UK, CAT, War and Want, State Watch. And we've come together to basically try to stop the proliferation of drones and try to push for our government to ultimately form a convention. Like we've got conventions against biological, chemical warfare, we've got a convention against banning use of landmines. We're moving towards and hopefully going to get a convention to ban nuclear missiles. In the same way, we want a convention to basically international legislation to limit the production and proliferation of drones. Problem is, though, the cat may already be out of the bag because you've got so many countries using it. Others who are seeking to acquire it. So it may be too late. I mean, one good website to look at, which is actually operated by the coordinator of the drone, coordinator of the DCN, a guy called Chris Cole, is at Drone Wars UK. He basically updates his website on a daily basis, and it's a good source for the latest drone news. But as part of the Week of Action, we're going to be doing various events. The Drones Campaign Network is going to be doing various events from the 8th to the 13th of October. We're going to be launching an online petition. We're going to be doing a peace walk around Lincolnshire. We'll be holding various talks. MEDEX launching the report to coincide with that, and then we're going to have the further launch at House of Commons 2 weeks after that, because MPs don't come back until after the 15th, so we have to postpone it until the MPs are back. I'm speaking on a panel debate in London on the 30th of October as well. We're going to have someone there from the two retired military personnel, myself and Chris Coles, engaging in a friendly panel debate. So if anyone's down in London, you want to come along to the Royal Society of Medicine, I can send you details. But yeah, there's a lot going on at the moment. I can send anyone links for further info if they like. Thank you very much.
Thank you.